Alright, welcome to the Chris Files members. Adam plugging in here on Monday night, the 12th of December. And this is the Reading and Observation Podcast with Adam. You'll be able to find this podcast in the members area only. If you log into the members area, you'll see them in there. There's also the Night Watch podcast. Have a look for those. And did a new normal podcast today up with Leon Pittard. So that's up and out there. So have a listen to that. This is a new podcast section where I just talk about things that interest me, and break down all sorts of things. I hope you guys are doing fine out there. Just going to continue on from the last podcast that I was doing, and continuing with older articles quite a lot of years ago, one again from Anthony Peake, which I have a few of the books as well, and this one was Cheating the Ferryman, A New Paradigm of Existence. So what happens when we die? This is the ultimate question, isn't it? And I guess one that we still have no real answer. So from the first few moments that man became a self-aware being, he has pondered upon this mystery. It really is a great mystery, isn't it? Every culture has attempted an explanation. And it is reasonable to conclude that all religions exist to give an account of what happens at that moment. And more importantly, where does the person go after their body dies? One of the most enduring myths is that of the ancient Greeks. They believed that the recently dead would find themselves at the banks of a vast river, the River Styx. Out of the mists would appear Charon, the ferryman. It was his job to ferry the soul, termed a shade, across to the other side, to the land of the dead. But he did not do this for free. He needed a payment, so the relatives of the recently dead person made sure the shade could pay the ferryman, which is really interesting, isn't it? And this payment was usually a small coin called an obulus, depending upon the tradition. So either this would be placed under the tongue of the corpse, or the oboli would be placed over each eye. So this well-known myth still resonates over 3,000 years later to pay the ferryman. Can still be heard to today. However, there is a lesser known myth that suggests a deeper truth, the myth of the river Lethe. The Greeks believed that before getting to the banks of the Styx, the shade would encounter a much smaller tributary of the great river. This could be crossed with ease by wading from bank to bank. This small river was called the Lethe, and its waters contained a profoundly important quality. If the shade or newly deceased soul drank of this water, all their memories would evaporate. They would forget who they are and the events of their life. Their memories would become like those of a newborn baby. Of course, by doing so, the shade also forgot all the lessons learned during that life. But before doing this, the shade had the option of drinking from a small pool next to the Lethe. This was the spring of Menmasane. By drinking here, the shade's past life memories became sharp and distinct. Each action and its subsequent effects became crystal clear, life's lessons became precise and understood. If the shade drank of the spring of Memosyne, they were allowed to pay the ferryman, board the boat, and sail across the Styx to the Elysian fields. But if a drop of the waters of the Lethe was drunk by the shade, then they were sent back to be reborn again with no memories of their previous life. Now, this was not a form of reincarnation, as it is understood by most people. It was a rebirth process in which the same life was lived again. The shade found itself back in its mother's womb, waiting to start all over again. And we talked about this on previous podcasts as well, a little bit with the deja vus. So this concept is called the eternal reoccurrence, which is really interesting, and has been a long-held alternative belief to that of the linear life found in most religions, even those who have reincarnation as their central belief system. However, those who have long held this belief never shared it with the masses. Such a belief has always been found in the secret esoteric groups within most of the major religions. This is the great secret carried through the ages by the groups loosely termed as the Gnostics. So the Gnostic tradition can be found behind the great mystery traditions of the Middle East and Europe, from the Manichaeans of Persia and the Cathari of southern France, and from the Kabbalists of southern Spanish Judaism to the Sufis of Arabia. This hidden knowledge is the real Holy Grail in whose defense the Knights Templar and the Albigensians died in their thousands to protect. In my books, I present evidence for this belief system that at the moment of death, we are catapulted back to our moment of birth. The theory is supported by a good deal of evidence from modern science, looking at quantum physics in particular, neurology and psychiatry and consciousness studies. I call this theory cheating the ferryman because I suggest many of us never make it across the River Styx. We never step into Charon's boat, and we never pay him his obulus. We cheat the ferryman out of his fare and return to live our lives again. On what evidence do I base such a totally weird idea? So dreams and precognitive deja vus. Well, for me, the whole theory started when one very peculiar dream. In this dream, I experienced a deja vu. Yes, a dream that contained the sensation that I was experiencing an event that I had dreamed before, if that makes sense. In the dream, I had an inner dialogue with another me, and this being stated that a deja vu is a memory of an event that you have lived before in a different life. I then woke up with this idea echoing around me. I had for some time wanted to write a book, and now it seemed that my dream self, or more accurately, a part of my dream self, had given me both the theme and the incentive. I was surprised to discover that deja vu is not only the most common anomalous psychological perception. 70% of people will experience the sensation at least once in their lives. I have them quite a bit, actually. They're really strange. But also that experts have no real idea what causes it. Various suggestions have been made, but none have ever shown to be correct. And this is something that we forget, isn't it, folks? The deja vu. When you're suddenly doing something in your day and boom, it's like an ice pick through your brain. And you think, oh my God, I've seen this. I've been here before. This exact situation, whether someone says something or offers something or something happens around. I get these quite strongly, quite a bit. How is that actually possible? The deja vu. where something's happening that you remember. Unless you can tell the future and you don't know it. So as an example, for many years, a proposal made by the psychiatrist Paul Efron was considered to have nailed the mystery. Efron suggested that one part of the brain processes information before the other. In this way, we have the feeling of experiencing an event twice. This occurs because each hemisphere of the brain receives signals from the right and left visual fields of each eye. As such, the non-dominant hemisphere processes the incoming images a split second before the dominant hemisphere. So, in effect, the consciousness receives the signal twice with a short time delay, as one signal is immediately but not fully overwritten by another. We feel as if we have experienced the images twice. But this curious message transferal only works for the eyes. It has recently been shown that, blind individuals, for example, experience oral deja vu sensations as the brain processes sound in a totally different way to sight. The Efron thesis simply cannot explain this form of deja vu. I wondered if déjà vu may not be simply what it feels it is, a curious sensation that suggests the observer has lived this moment before. The Seattle-based psychiatrist Dr. Vernon Nepe has defined déjà vu as any subjectively inappropriate impression of familiarity of the present experience with an undefined past. So the undefined past could be part of this life or a past life. However, this past life, for me, did not imply reincarnation for one simple reason. For a déjà vu sensation to be effective, it has to be a memory of the exact circumstances, not a circumstance that is similar. So, for example, if my subjectively, inappropriate impression consisted of me remembering being in this place in Victorian times, the two images would be quite different. The location may be the same, but my clothing, my companions, and the decor would be totally different. It would feel more like a time slip than a doubling of consciousness. For a déjà vu to be a déjà vu, the two impressions have to be identical in all ways. My memory of the event is identical to my experiencing of the event. I am reliving an event from my past, but a past that is, for the moment, the future. So indeed, I have now interviewed many people who experience precognitive déjà vus. The memory includes a remembrance of what happens or happened next. The subject suddenly has very short-term clairvoyance. I found that these precognitive déjà vu sensations are usually reported by individuals who experience three brain states: migraine, temporal lobe epilepsy, and schizophrenia. I was intrigued as to why this was the case and began researching what may link these three illnesses. So, much to my delight, I found there is one common factor, a neurotransmitter called glutamate. This is perception and time distortion. In a curious coincidence that was to have great significance to my later, I learned that neurotransmitters were first discovered by an Austrian scientist called Otto Lowy. Just like me, Lowy had a dream guider. On Easter Sunday 1920, he awoke in the middle of the night having experienced a really vivid dream. He wrote down what he had experienced and went back to sleep. The next morning, he excitedly looked at his notes to find them to be illegible scrawl. He knew that he had dreamed something of profound importance, so he went to bed early the next night. The dream came again, and when he woke, he reproduced his dream experiment exactly as he experienced it that night. In doing so, he isolated a substance that was to eventually be called acetylcholine. If I'm pronouncing that right. So such was the importance of this discovery that in 1936, Dr. Lowy and his English associate, Sir Henry Dale, were awarded the Nobel Prize. What Lowy's dream had helped find was the first example of the chemicals that were later to be called neurotransmitters anyway. These are internally generated substances that facilitate the transmission of messages from cell to cell within the body. The most important group is found in the brain, and glutamate is the most important of the brain neurotransmitters. Glutamate is directly responsible for the peculiar feelings described by migrainers, temporal lobe epileptics and schizophrenics, specifically a sensation that is technically known as the aura. So, the aura is a form of early warning system. It is triggered by overproduction of glutamate and usually takes place a short time before an attack of migraine or temporal lobe seizure. Glutamate's role in schizophrenia is different, but the overall outcome is similar. Experiences report sensations of time slowing down, or hypersensitivity, or visual or oral hallucinations, and profound deja vu sensations. Deja vu had been linked with both migraine and TLE for years before Lowy's serendipitous discovery. Here was the link I had been looking for. Deja vu has as one of its causes a flood of glutamate in the brain. It was then that I made my first big step to cheating the ferryman. Quite by chance, I was reading an old book I had on near-death experiences. One of the more technical articles discussed the neurochemical causes of the near-death experience. Much to my surprise, I found that glutamate was also connected to this well-reported experience. Another and quite unrelated article in the same book discussed one of the most commonly reported elements of the NDE, what is technically known as the panoramic life review. "My life flashed before my eyes" is a quotation recorded time and time again by people who have close encounters with death. Some report the experience as seeing a series of snapshots, others that they relive every experience of their life, but in super speed. Playing a movie in mega fast forward. So one person reported that it was as if somebody had recorded a movie of his life and was running it in fast forward, as I just said. I was fascinated by this link. Both deja vu and the panoramic life review were linked by a specific brain chemical, glutamate. After doing some subsequent research, I found that Dr. Carl Janssen of the Maudsley Hospital in London had been able to reproduce a full near-death experience in volunteers when he had them take small doses of the drug ketamine. Now, ketamine is chemically almost identical to glutamate, so here again we had an amazing link. I was later to find that ketamine and glutamate also brings about another curious subjective sensation in the brain. Time slows down or almost stops for the experiencer. In another fortuitous event, I was to be given a first-hand description of a glutamate effect by a person who experienced the TLE seizures. Temporal lobe epilepsy breakthrough. I received a phone call one afternoon. It was a lady from a recruitment agency who was wishing to discuss with me a vacancy she was handling. Margaret asked me whether I was working, and I explained that I was driven to write a book. "What about?" she asked. "I don't really know at the moment," I truthfully responded. I then explained that I was reading a good deal about temporal lobe epilepsy and was making some fascinating links. She went very quiet and suggested that we should meet up to discuss the vacancy. 3 days later, I met her at a coffee shop nearby. As soon as she had sat down, she explained to me that she had to meet me because she wished to discuss with me something she could not mention in her office where she would have been overheard. Margaret informed me that she had recently been diagnosed as having temporal lobe epilepsy. She described to me how she had first discovered that something unusual was happening in her brain. She had been having lunch with a work associate in a crowded cafe. As her associate started to pour a cup of tea from a teapot, she suddenly felt a snap over her right ear. Surprised by this, she looked at her associate, assuming that she too would have heard the noise. One look told her that her lunch companion had heard nothing. This was because she had stopped moving. The stunned recruitment consultant looked around the cafe, and every person was frozen in time and space. It was as if she had suddenly found herself in a three-dimensional photograph. She could hear a low humming sound that seemed all around her. She then looked back at her companion to notice that she was not frozen at all. She was moving incredibly slowly. So Margaret then realized that the low hum she could hear was, in fact, people's voices. Her metabolic rate had increased to such an extent that time had slowed down to a crawl. She watched in amazement as the tea slowly appeared from the spout of the teapot and slowly fell into the cup. Margaret assured me that this took hours to take place in her mind. At that point, she made a fascinating comment. She said that she could have been in this state for days, months, years, even a lifetime. Then after what seemed like many hours, Margaret felt another snap over her right ear and her associate finished pouring the tea and sat back. Are you okay? She asked. "I'm not sure," replied Margaret. Her friend then explained that Margaret had suddenly stopped moving and had stared into space for about 20 seconds. As Margaret explained to me, those 20 seconds had been hours for her. She went on to tell me that she feared she had a brain tumor, but after a series of scans, she was told that she had TLE. I was amazed at this story. Here was evidence that glutamate, when it floods the brain, does indeed slow subjective time to an absolute crawl. For some reason, I then asked Margaret if she experienced deja vu. "I get deja vus to kill for," was her reply. Not only that, but when I am in this pre-seizure aura state, I know what is going to happen next. I really do see the future. My meeting with Margaret presented me with the final piece of a jigsaw puzzle that I had not known until that moment. I was trying to complete. I knew then what the book would be about. Not an explanation for deja vu, but something much bigger, an explanation as to what happens to human consciousness at the point of death. My theory was both simple but stunning. Deja vu sensations are exactly what they seem to be. They are recollections of past events, otherwise known as lost memories. So how can we remember the future? Simple. Because the future is also the past. Confused? Well, the best way to explain this is to give a fictitious example based upon an amalgamation of many NDE reports. This is another bit here, the physics of NDEs. Our hero is a skydiver. He is very unlucky skydiver because his parachute has refused to open and he forgot to pack his backup chute. As he plummets to the ground, there will be a point where the stress levels will be so high that glutamate floods the brain. In doing so, it brings about the subjective slowing down of time. Indeed, for the skydiver, the duration of time slows down to a virtual standstill, but his brain remains completely active. Just as he is about to hit the ground, his motion through space is slowed by the fact that his motion through time has been changed. As we know from the theories of Albert Einstein, time and space are the same thing and they are relative to the observer. This is where the word relativity comes from. So relative to the skydiver, time duration has slowed down to a crawl. For him, a split second can last days, weeks, years, even a lifetime. This is exactly what Margaret experienced in the canteen. What happens then? Well, something very strange. Recall that many people who report near-death experiences explain they see their lives flash before their eyes. This is a near-death experience. Our skydiver is in a real death experience. There is no way he will survive the impact with the ground. In this case, his life does not flash before his eyes, but he experiences it in literal minute-by-minute recreation of his life from the moment of his birth. In effect, he lives his whole life again, and at the end of the second life, it happens again and again and again. It is like the movie Groundhog Day, but it is not a day, but a life, and all this takes place in the split second before he hits the ground. This is how he cheats the ferryman. In his subjective time frame, he never reaches the point of death because it is always in his future. But there is more. And this is where things get really interesting. I suggest each life rerun is not like a pre-recorded movie that cannot be changed, but more like a video game in which all consequences of all decisions are already programmed in. By applying the latest findings of quantum physics, I present a model whereby the implications of something called the many worlds interpretation can be shown to follow such a scenario. So put simply, according to the MWI hypothesis, there are billions of versions of each person, and each one of these versions have the capacity to live out and lay down replayable memories. The outcomes of every decision made in a lifetime, there is available to each person a recording of every possible life they could live. I call this recording Bohmian IMAX. The Bohmian IMAX. Others may recognize it as the Akashic Record or the Akashic Field of Professor Irvine Laszlo. I further suggest that at the point of death, consciousness splits into two elements, and I term these the Eidolon and the Daimon. The Eidolon is the everyday being that calls itself I, or me, and it has no knowledge of its previous lives. The Daimon is different. It carries all the memories of the past life or lives, and as such, it acts as a form of higher self or guardian angel. In my books, I present evidence from modern neurological research to suggest this may be the case. Isn't this interesting, folks? Looking at my last podcast doing this here. That is really interesting. The Daimon. This higher self. Or guardian angel. So the changes that bring about a new life path are instigated by the Daimon. When it warns the Eidolon of potential dangers lying waiting in the future, these can be conveyed through dreams, precognitions, inklings, voices, and many other subtle methods. Possibly even a deja vu sensation. We don't just cheat the ferryman, we are also given opportunities to change things and possibly put things right or put right the wrong things that we've done or we do. I agree that on first encountering this hypothesis, it is both bizarre and incredible, but the science does seem to work. Could this be the paradigm changer that we have all been waiting for? Really interesting, huh? I found that a fascinating article, and his work is just amazing. And I've got that actual original first book. This by PMH Atwater. Is the afterlife what we think it is? A challenge from near-death studies. There are millions of stories now of near-death experiences from around the world, each a snippet, a teaser of what appears to exist on the other side of death. No other human drama carries quite the power this phenomenon does to unmask traditions of a grim reaper and reveal instead an aliveness that continues after our bodies take their last breath and our brains cease to function. This aliveness we call an afterlife, because in most cases what near-death experiences describe sounds like or certainly seems to be a sparkling illuminations of a higher, finer aspects to what we know. Cities, gardens, forests, landscapes, roads, rivers, busy people, quite alive and doing things, schools, hospitals, opportunities of varied types to reassess earthly existence, to forgive, learn, and then advance toward a goal we can only term spiritual. Because the stories that come from experiences are so compelling, I'd like to share a few from my research base. Shortly after hearing them, you will be more than impressed that an afterlife must indeed exist and that life goes on after we die. Once I have shared these accounts, though, I intend to introduce others that will stretch what we think we know about life after death. The concept of afterlife may not be as previously stated or broadly believed. Stories, as many of them. Arthur E. Jensen died in 1932, at least as near as we can tell he did, from severe injuries in an automobile accident. The vividness of what happened next remained fresh in his memory, not only after he revived, but throughout what later became a long and productive life. As Jensen put it, gradually the Earth's scene faded away, and through it loomed a bright, new, beautiful world. Beautiful beyond imagination. For a half a minute, I could see both worlds at once. Finally, when the earth was all gone, I stood in a glory that could only be heaven. In the background were two beautiful round-topped mountains, similar to Mount Fuji in Japan, he continued. The tops were snow-capped, and the slopes were adorned with foliage of absolute beauty. The mountains appeared to be about 14 or 15 miles away, yet I could see individual flowers growing on their slopes, like using high-powered binoculars, you know what I mean? I estimated my vision to be about 100 times better than on Earth. To the left was a shimmering lake containing a different kind of water, clear, golden, radiant, and alluring. It seemed to be alive, though. The whole landscape was carpeted with grass so vivid, clear, and green that it defies description. To the right was a grove of large, luxuriant trees, composed of the same clear material that seemed to make up everything. I have had dreams kind of like this as well, with these massive forests. It was so strange. Jensen described the people there as young-looking and lively, yet possessing a weightless grace in their movements. Their bodies were somewhat translucent, so was the grass and the trees, their clothing minimal. One man told him, "Everything over here is pure. The elements don't mix or break down as they do on Earth. Everything is kept in place by an all-pervading master vibration, which prevents aging. That's why things don't get dirty or wear out, and why everything looks so bright and new. Jensen learned how heaven could be eternal from this man. At Water, 1994, 5355. Muriel E. Kelly, weakened by rheumatic fever and a series of heart murmur, because very ill, or she became very ill and passed into another world. I found myself standing on a cobblestone road with people around me dressed in bright robes, red, blue, pink. Everything was so bright and sunny. Birds were singing. Baby angels were smiling and flying around. I saw all different sizes of angels. The music was hauntingly beautiful. Hearing her name called, Muriel turned to see Jesus beside her, dressed in a white and red robe. He knelt down. She said, and he gave me a hug, and I hugged him back. He told me we were going somewhere to talk. During the course of their time together, Jesus led her to an apartment building with many doors and told her which door to knock on. A voice inside beckoned her to enter. It was her mother, who had died when Muriel was 9 years old, leaving behind 5 children. Their reunion was love-filled. I asked Mama where Daddy was, and Cecil, Willie, John, and Paul. Mother told me they weren't there because it wasn't their time. I had no idea what she meant, so she took me to an area where we sat on a cloud and looked over the whole world. My mother located my dad and brothers riding in a car. We could see right through it. Dad was driving, and we heard my brothers and dad crying, saying I was with Muriel. I wish Muriel was still here. We miss her. Muriel began to cry for her earthly family and wished to be back with them. She got her wish. And this is a strange thing as well. I've talked to Wayne Bush and others about this, mainly Wayne, and we discussed this, how in this near-death experiences, people may be seeing what they want to see, you know, like kind of what they believed in so strongly in their life. And some people may be very, very extremely religious and believe in Jesus, you know, and this is what may be presented to them in this experience. Just depending on what they believe in is what they could be shown. You know what I mean? Sort of like a shape-shifting sort of thing. That's just something to put into that subject as well. Cecil L. Hamilton told of swimming with his brother. He had a problem. I tried to get him out of the water, but in his panic, he pulled me under several times. We both drowned. He died, but I came back. While Hamilton was in the grips of death, he suddenly found himself stepping into a light-filled world. I noticed everything, sky, buildings, grass. Glass emitted its own light, and everything was much more colourful. A river meandered around. On the other side was a city and a road running through it to another city and another city and another and another. Right in front of me, but across the river, were 3 men. They projected themselves to me. They didn't walk or fly. They projected over. I didn't recognize them, yet I knew one was Lynn Bibb. Hamilton explained, I was named after him. He died a matter of weeks before I was born. Hamilton continued with his story anyway. I knew these 3 men were looking out for me, like a welcoming committee, to escort me over the river to the first city. I had the feeling that if I went with them, there would be no coming back, so I hesitated. The first city was like the first grade. People stayed there until they were ready to go to the next city. Your eternal progression from city to city. Behind me and to the left was a strong light source, very brilliant and filled with love. I knew it was a person. I called it God, for lack of a better term. I could not see it. I felt what seemed like a male presence. God and Hamilton engaged in a long conversation. The young man asked him about the universe and reasons for everything. Then God questioned if Hamilton wanted to return to the physical world. "I do want to return," he said. God asked why. "I said I would help my mother, whom my father had left with four children and one on the way." God kind of chuckled and asked for the real reason. "I said I would leave the earth a little bit better than I found it. Then you may return with some of the knowledge of the things you have learned. But the rest will be veiled for a time. Live in such a way that you will not feel bad when you return here again." I woke up face down in the mud of the river bottom and was lifted to the top. Each of these, three accounts describes a particular arrangement of structures, shapes, people, and behaviors that are familiar to us, adding heft to the belief that the afterlife either reflects our earthly life or is an extension of it. So the testimonies that follow, however, deviate from what I have just relayed. The focus with them is more fluid, with an absence of structured form. I'll begin with the near-death experience of Ray Kinman, that he had as a teenager from an accidental overdose. This is a very difficult to describe, cautioned Kinman. Time ceased to exist, past and future, more completely non-existent. I was traveling in an intense burning now was everything. I ceased to be a noun, person, place, or thing, and became a verb, an action. I was raying instead of ray. I was given a huge message. The being told me, "This is who you really are." As the universe opened up to me, I could not tell the difference between myself and the infinite. I became all-powerful and all-knowing, yet I was still Ray. Then the being introduced me to another being of the most incredible beauty and love that anyone could comprehend. It was a greater being of intense light. It was God. The first being guided me to this light and let it enfold and swallow me up. I became one with love times a million billion trillion forever and ever. We were made of the same stuff. Every being that had ever existed in all creation was now part of this greater whole being called God. I was one with all of them, and yet I was still Ray, all-powerful, little old me. "This is who you really are," thundered the light. It looked like a galaxy, except the points of light were not stars, they were beings. Every being there was singing this incredibly beautiful music. After some indefinite length of nowness, I was told that I must go back. I was given another message that was very important. I was told I may return any time I wished to. Coming back to my body felt like I was stuffed into a vessel of pain and exhaustion. Kinman was very clear that this was not like any drug experience. This was truth. He was shown the way things really are. Tanis Proughton had a severe anxiety attack that seemed to claim her life. As she explains, "I felt like ducking as the ceiling was only an inch from me. Then I was outside, moving through very dark, very vast space." She saw small, round, glowing spheres around her that she came to realize were lost souls. Before she could react very rapidly, I was enveloped within this most divine, living, golden white light, my home. The joy, bliss, humility, awe were beyond human capability to bear. The light was an infinite, loving, accepting being without form. It had personality. It communicated with me telepathically. It was pure truth. As the intensity of her experience increased, she came to realize I was the light and the light was me. I was still a unique, separate point of consciousness with the same sense of humor and awareness that I always had. But the paradox is that I was more. I had become homogeneous, with the light. I was all love, wisdom, truth, peace, joy, for all eternity. Human words fail to express this experience. Not only was the message of my true nature conveyed to me telepathically, but I experienced the spirit of the message. I felt it with every speck of my being. There was absolutely no possibility of hiding, distorting information, or lying in communicating with the light. I fell madly in love with the spirit of truth. There was no concept of space or time in the greater reality. All takes place or exists in the eternal now. That is my last conscious memory of this experience. Who or what are we really falling in love with when we do fall in love and when we're feeling these powerful emotions? Near-death experiences that challenge accepted notions. So many near-death episodes are like the last two that we read and seeming to counter the idea of biblical, religious, medieval, or even mythological traditions of an afterlife that features core imagery, basic of the spread of culture and, looking at the human family. Consensus throughout the human family, basically. So we have a long history of such commonalities, especially in regards to death. So the greatest of all mysteries, and what happens to us after we die? Findings in the field of near-death studies, though, are beginning to challenge not only traditional but non-traditional beliefs as well. So maybe there's more to learn from our shared histories than what we thought. Seeing beyond the veil of death. It is easy to assume that the four people who had matching hellish experiences, and I've got a book on this as well. These are people that have these hell type experiences in the NDEs as well. Met in dying what they had repressed during their lives, negative emotions that were still eating away at them, such as assumption, would be in keeping with the writings of Emanuel Swedenborg, an incredible scientist several centuries back who had also mastered the ability to see beyond the veil of death. It was his contention that after we died, we entered realms of our own making, based on our attitudes and beliefs. We could expand on this idea by inferring that because the hellish accounts were virtually identical, there could have existed at that hospital a type of energy, perhaps from previous emotional outbursts, that the four of them unconsciously activated in a similar fashion to outpicture their deeply held beliefs. Possible, yes, but there is more to consider. The group experience of 20 hotshot firefighters challenges the conclusions of Swedenborg and anyone else, myself included, who tried to tie near-death scenarios solely to the attitudes and beliefs of experiences. The idea that you get what you expect, what appears to be obvious may not necessarily be as true as it seems. There are lots of shared experiences, such as between a parent and child in the same accidents, between friends who die together and revive also. So between people who never knew each other but found out about their mutual episodes years later, once they started asking questions, people on opposite sides of the world can go through the same things at the same or different times, yet their separate lives, beliefs and feelings do not match, nor did they ever, even though their near-death experiences did. And there are even incidences like what happened to Nadia McCaffrey. Nadia was a participant in the original research I conducted with child experiences of near-death states. Years later, while caring for a woman who was dying, she nearly died herself following several seizures. And several days afterwards, still in pain, she called me and we exchanged stories. The upshot was that Nadia's seizures had begun at the same moment our granddaughter Miriam's seizures had. When Nadia died, so had Miriam from bacterial meningitis. The two met each other in spirit as they died. Miriam enabled Nadia to have another near-death experience. This time, this time one that clarified and detailed her life's mission. Miriam had always been unique in this regard, for she had the ability to force, push, or aid a person in accessing their own inner truth. Nadia's first near-death experience had left her with many questions, especially about her purpose for being alive. Her second one, thanks to Miriam, filled in the missing pieces and helped her launch a new type of hospice. How can this incident be explained, or any of those I've shared? Do our moments at the edge of death or while clinically dead really unveil an afterlife? Or is there something else going on that we miss in our great hurry or even greater desire to accommodate what is before us and name it what our traditions claim to be? Two clues present in almost every case I have worked on caused me to toss the notion of afterlife. I no longer consider it relevant. To help you understand why I say this, a presentation of the clues and my observations are here. Clue one, almost to a person near-death experiences, say, I got what I needed. To an extent, Swedenborg was right. What he missed is what people really meant when they spoke such words, and the broader perspective necessary to interpret what people experienced and what he himself actually witnessed. Being literal isn't always productive. It's like trying to see an aura. Aim your gaze a little past what is in front of you, and suddenly you begin to see things you never recognized before. Do this with the phrase, I got what I needed, and you'll notice, as I did, that near-death experience unfolds in patterning that mimics an accelerated growth event. Life insists on growth and change. If we block these urges, something will happen to unblock them. That something is what I call a growth event. A growth event is any kind of sudden, unexpected twist in life that twirls you around and changes your attitudes and stretches your mind. Growth events, all of them, give us an opportunity to face our inner selves and be honest about what we find. To glimpse higher, more spiritual realities, to expand beyond limiting ideas, to discover the impossible and experience the paranormal. To become in some way transformed, I believe the near-death experience is a growth event, perhaps one of those that seems reserved for people who need a good shove in making life changes. Here is a brief synopsis of what I found that underscores this. I myself was having a pretty terrible time back in the 90s at some point, a really bad time, very lost, got kicked out of school, didn't know what was going on. I walked in front of a car and I could have been killed. I didn't have a near-death experience, but it was a really strange event. Anyway, and And I get this right through when I'm thinking the wrong way, or I'm doing the wrong things, or, you know, I'm thinking negatively, whatever. I seem to get this shove. This voice comes into my head and says, "What are you doing? This is the wrong thing." You know, and I think this is all part of learning. It's all part of learning, and in no way, shape, or form is it bad to think bad things, or to watch bad things, or to participate in bad things. It's all part of learning, you know. You will get that strong sensation, which is almost like a voice in your mind or in your head or around you telling you. And I feel like this is a natural intuition, which is, it worries me that our natural basic human intuition, you know, is being buried by all this technology and voice-to-skull stuff that we've been talking about, that the they can put stuff in our heads and make us think certain ways using technology and frequencies and microwave frequencies and all of this. We know watching too much TV, watching too much movies, leaving the devices on and the Wi-Fi on when you go to sleep at night can give you these really crazy, like, kind of dreams. And this is interference, isn't it, as well? Most near-death episodes happen during major junctures of times of unusual stress in the individual's life when guidance or directions would be most helpful. Young children, relatives, and caregivers can be affected as well, to the degree that it is almost as if the child had the experience for them. Yet the extent to which the episode transformed the youngster becomes more apparent as he or she matures and can be a quiet but powerful directive in the life path chosen. Causes and conditions of death can reflect, at least symbolically, the experience's past or current state of psychological growth. Greeters on death's threshold always match, accommodate to, whatever is necessary to alert or calm the experiencer. As the episode deepens, the scenario's message parallels almost exactly the subconscious needs of the individual at the moment in time. Life reviews and lecture sessions cover material either omitted, ignored, or not yet learned in life by the individual involved. Life previews alert to what might be the future for good or ill. Afterward, the experiencer's behavior tends to shift to whatever has been underdeveloped or partially developed. Physically, in the sense of brain function, nerve sensitivity, and psychologically, in their sense of personal growth or maturity, as if whatever traits are missing in the individual's maturing process are now being filled in. So whatever the truth of this is, and it may never be proved one way or the other, the need factor is plainly obvious as to the timing, storyline, and outcome of near-death states. Not in the sense of predetermination, rewards, punishment, or wish or fulfillment, but rather in terms of subconscious agenda of a higher order. So clue two, the most oft repeated phrase near-death experiences say after their episode is always, "There is life." This fact struck me. If it is true, and I believe it is, then how can there be an afterlife or a before life or anything else but life? Implied here is that in some form, somewhere, somehow, eternal and forever, life exists as an ongoing extension of itself. So acting upon and interacting within itself, ever conscious, intelligent and aware. Life unending. Indicated as well is that we are that life, existent within the existence of a forever that can be counted on. So these four words sum up and explain all else. They take us beyond attitudes, dictums, dogmas, preferences, traditions, even what we are able to imagine these four words as if a prayer is answered. This is really interesting, isn't it? Because you think, well, what am I doing now? Is this a dream? As we stated on the last podcast, you know, is our consciousness projecting this so-called reality that we're living now? But every night when we lay our heads down and we go to sleep, we go into this other dream world. And as I've always said from the Matrix film, if you had a dream that was so real and you couldn't wake up from that dream, how would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world? This world that I'm talking to you now, or is this real? So what is real? And we look at it like, oh, we're born and we live and then we die. And we look at the death experience and we attach that to being buried in the ground. And that's what brings on the fear of death, that we're in that body. And we've discussed this as well. But this is really interesting looking at it as a continuation. Like, this is no different what I'm doing now to when I'm dead. It's just a different kind of platform, you know what I mean? So it's all the one continuous experience. So once I recognize the import of this, all the experience narratives I had ever encountered or heard from other researchers made sense. If you allow yourself to step back from all the Minutiae, who said what, where, and under what conditions, a different picture emerges that transcends the individual storylines from both adults and children. That different picture describes a vastness to creation we are a part of, while focusing in on the souls that we are, as we participate in a journey of awakening to our real identity and purpose. What reality really is. Tens of thousands of reported cases, not only in the Western world, but throughout Africa, China, Indian, Pacific Rim, Russia, Thailand, Korea, Turkey, from jungle dwellers to desert clans, from the backs of buffalo riders to the canyons of Wall Street. The near-death phenomenon, if viewed as it occurs at the time that it does, offers a picture of the other side of death that mirrors what quantum physics seeks to uncover and explain. That all is consciousness and everything else is illusion. With experiencer estimates running between 4 to 5% of the general population worldwide, umpteen million are involved. The phenomenon is that widespread. So looking at the 12 heavens and hells in this other piece here, it is no small thing then for us to take a second look at what has been reported. The concept of heaven and hell changes when we do this. Near-death states show that once you leave your body in death, regardless of whatever comes next, you eventually find yourself moving to or present within an energy frequency you resonate with. So what you find there corresponds, for the most part, to what you are capable of responding to, i.e. being shapes, forms, or activities. This is what you want, what you believe in. This is what's being reflected to you. These frequency realms resemble a layer cake or many levels, each separated from the other by degrees of lighter or heavier vibrations. The heavier, more dense vibrations hold what most people call hell, in that they consist of negative or lower forms of thought that reside in close proximity to the earth plane. Apparently, you stay within the range of vibrations for as long as it best serves your development as a soul. You do not leave until you have changed your attitudes, thoughts, and feelings, and are ready for another opportunity to improve and advance. The faster, higher, more subtle vibrations are what most people term heaven, and they are also in close proximity to the earth plane. There is a sense of benefit here, as if one has found one's true home. You leave whatever level of this positive, supportive domain you are in once you have further advanced as an awakened soul and are more unified in spirit. I have countered from experience and descriptions what appears to be the existence of 12 heavens and 12 hells. Yet this layer cake of energy frequencies, layered thought form realms, seems to be open at both ends. I have found nothing to indicate otherwise. Claims of souls forever and internally trapped or condemned in their heavier levels, or basking in the glory of ascension in the finer, lighter ones, do not hold up. When you really study the import of what people encounter on the other side of death, you come to realize that unlimited possibilities are available because of the power unleashed from awakenings. To whatever degree a soul awakens, consciousness expands individually and universally. Yes, detours are reported to places like borderlands, shadow areas, where individuals in spirit form may tarry. It seems that in some cases where the ego personality refuses to merge with its soul, spirit can remain apart somehow, as if it's lost, disconnected, confused, or determined to fulfill a vow or a promise before moving on. Barry Eaton talked about this on some of the podcasts, the earlier ones that we did, that some of these negative entities, like these people who pass over, they might kind of end up in these kind of planes where there's nothing there and stuff like that. We talked about that. Dark city environments, things just depending on how they live their lives and how they thought. So the idea then of way stations is upheld in near-death accounts, places where spirits reside until helped in some fashion. These catch-all places appear to be necessary diversions so that one can shake free of initially hinders. What matters most throughout this entire arrangement of heaven, hell, borderlands, though, is the resonance factor. Like attracts like. Our religions insist that it is deeds done or not done that is the final determinant of where we wind up once dead. Yet nothing from experience or cases fully validates this. Their testimony indicates something else, that self-acceptance or self-rejection is what creates our energetic signal. So another section here is time, space, soul, and God. The concept of time space also changes when we take that second look. Near-death experiences are adamant in stating that neither time nor space exist. They claim that everything on the other side of death resides in a kind of now moment devoid of boundaries, limits, or definitions, other than that of the relationship between perception and perceivers. Time and space are seen as purposeful, however. From the bulk of near-death accounts, time is experienced by individuals as a type of doorway. Space moves through in sparkling waveforms of potential. That sparkle comes from light in the process of becoming dense enough within the cradle of space to take on shapes and forms of what is termed matter. What becomes apparent from experience or testimony, however, is that, in a way, few can understand or explain, time not only enables but protects the manifestation of existence that space allows. So thought can reproduce itself, its consciousness. It's as if all of life, every tiny speck of it, all of what we encounter on the other side of death, every vibratory wiggle of it exists as it does within a giant brain processing thought, and we are projections of that thought, and so is everything else. What we talked about on the other podcast, that this this light structure, it's projecting us, but we're actually all part of it. This brings us to another way of considering the soul. near-death states illuminate the reality of a soul, our soul, everybody's soul, and establish soul as a power source without form or gender. Some call it our higher self or our greater self, and that we as a soul are immortal, an extension of the divine. Soul is experienced as having its own will and an agenda above and beyond anything we might relate to from the personality level of our egos. I'm going to be talking a bit more about the ego stuff and this as well in the next podcast coming up, bringing that up. So what emerges from this discovery is the realization that souls go through learning cycles similar in purpose to people on Earth, and that souls can and often do incarnate in groups to accomplish specific things of a larger nature. The soul level of our being is recognized as possessing perfect memory and an almost unbelievable grasp of creation's story and our place in its overall scheme. On this level, which most experiencers consider a higher level of being, the goal of continued incarnations is human or other in human or other forms appears to be a furtherance of what can be experienced creatively, as we seek to expand our roles as co-creators with the Creator, winding our way through peaks and valleys of humanness appears to aid in this process. You get a real sense that life and death and the forms we take on fulfill an even higher will for an even greater purpose. With that said, we can approach the topic of God. The greatest discovery the vast majority of near-death experiences make after realizing there is life on the other side of death is that an intelligence beyond what we can fathom exists. There is a deity, and that deity or God is so massive and so powerful and so encompassing that it is often described by experiencers as more a brilliant and mighty than a million suns, existent as a presence without need or name, identity or definition. The biblical injunction to call it I am that I am suffices as a reference. All that exists is seen to exist within this allness, this oneness. It is as if there is only one mind, yet many thinkers. This, the one mind, is often described as spreading out from a webbing or matrix field of its own consciousness, embracing what exists from the stirring of its own thought. Changeless as the supreme consciousness it is, the one appears ever-changing once projections of its thought take on free will and the endless variation possible in that freedom. Life is God made visible. The awesomeness of this tends to dissolve any ideas of previous beliefs anyone ever had about religious dictums or mythological characterizations. A favorite phrase experiencers come to use is, we are one with the one. When reconsidering near-death cases, realize as you do that four patterns to the phenomenon exist, not just one. So the spread that follows results if you also factor in deviations in experience of behavior and beliefs before and after their episode. Initial experience, very few elements, and an introduction for the individual to other ways of perceiving reality, stimulus, unpleasant or hellish experiences, frightening scenarios, a confrontation with distortions in one's own attitudes and beliefs, healing. Pleasant or heavenly experiences, uplifting scenarios, a realization of how important life is and how every effort that one makes counts, validation. Transcendent experience, limitless expanses, an encounter with oneness and the collective whole of humankind, enlightenment. If you are objective about this spread, what you see here is a fascinating panorama. not about the existence of an afterlife and the do's and don'ts of living, but of what very well could be the movement of our consciousness as it evolves through the human condition via stages of awakening. These stages of awakening extend from the first realization of something greater and initial awareness to confrontations with the bias of perception, followed by opportunities to cleanse and start anew. This leads to the bliss and the ecstasy of self-validation and the discovery of one's worth, until at last the moment comes when unlimited realms of truth and wisdom are embraced. It's all about consciousness moving in and through our story and larger types of stories as the one mind experiences itself through variation in its thought. Still, there is more to note here. Present in the experiencer accounts is a deeper sense seldom vocalized that consciousness itself, by itself, as itself, is also awakening and expanding. To give this meaning, let me quote Saint Teresa of Avila, the great Spanish mystic and reformer, who near the end of her life said, "The feeling remains that God is on the journey too." The invitation here is for us to move past defining concepts and ideas of an afterlife that are birth to death centered, and embrace instead a new vision of life as an emanation of spirit, evolving in its capacity to handle the power from its source. Why limit ourselves? Experiences don't. That's a really interesting finish there. And I'll plug out tonight. I hope you guys are doing fine and listening. I will continue through these papers on the next one as we go deeper here. There's a lot of great stuff that I've got here, and I'll continue to pour through if you enjoy this, these podcasts. And thanks so much to the members for your support. These new podcasts are only in the members area, so get in and check if they're up. And there's other podcasts going up, and the Night Watch ones as well, when I can do those. And keep active on the website and logging into the members area. Always so much to go over. It's Monday night here anyway in Sydney, Australia, and great going over this information tonight with you guys. And please take care. And look for some more podcasts soon.